You are now listening to Icons and Icons, a Final Fantasy XIV game club podcast. This is episode 62, covering Sir Aymeric's rescue from the vault. I am your host, Chris Taylor. My pronouns are he, him. With me is my esteemed co-host,
Ryan Beatty. My pronouns are they, them.
What happened last time?
So fucking much. Okay, so last episode, we learned the truth about the third dragon eye that has been making the rounds. It belonged to Horace Felger, who bequeathed one of his eyes to Nidhogg so his brother could begin his thousand-year campaign of vengeance, which means that Horace Felger was also kind of complicit in the Dragon Song War. After learning this revelation, Ysael realized that her campaign of terror to expose the truth of Ishgard's past was itself based on a lie and decided to finally, like, full-throatedly join us. We headed back to Ishgard to find it embroiled in unrest that was blamed on the heretics, but was actually fomented by the Temple Knights and the Heaven's Ward. The Temple Knights were not prepared for Ysael to just, like, come in and be like, hey, my people, stop the fighting. And so they had to scramble to, like, do what they were continuing to try to do. Sir Aymeric, sick of seeing his city fighting with each other all the time, had a plan to confront Archbishop Thordin and demand that he reveal the truth of the Knights 12's betrayal and the illegitimacy of the High Houses to the people of Ishgard. Everyone thought that this was a dumb idea that will get Aymeric executed, even if he is Thordin's bastard son, like the rumors say. We hatched a plan to break him out of Pope jail and went searching for the rumored leader of a band of lowborn revolutionaries who calls herself the Mongrel. We learned a bunch of her life story, but did not actually track her down last episode. We begin this episode with a quest called Fire and Blood.
Sorry, I'm calculating taxes. Complete order. All right. We've heard the Mongrel's backstory, but we still don't quite know how to draw her out, so we speak to Chataru, and suddenly Alphadode remembers she's gone off to the broom to make inquiries herself. He fears for her safety down there, and we run off to find her. After a little searching, we find her trying to escape a pair of angry broom denizens named Filthy Fellow and Beggarly Fellow. Beggarly Fellow is my favorite one. That's my favorite. Yeah. Second favorite name this episode. The men quarter her in an alley, and she apologizes if she offended them. We come upon them, and they tell Alphadode to piss off when he intervenes. One of the men recognizes us and knows we're associated with House Fortomp somehow. It's because he has nothing to do all day on account of not having a job, so he just watches us go inside and outside of our house, and full employment is actually an issue of personal privacy. They accuse us of skulking around the broom, looking for signs of heresy to please our high-born masters. An Alphanode counters that we came here to help, but makes the mistake of saying, if you know what's good for you, you'll let us pass. If this could be solved if we talked, we could have just told him about that time we kicked an Inquisitor off a cliff.
Yeah, come on.
The men laugh at his threat and then go to kick his ass, and Tataru is cowering, crouched forward, eyes shut, and trembling hands gripping her very large hat. And suddenly a gruff voice yells at the men to leave us all alone and leave the threatening of women and children to their betters.
The camera then cuts to a black-haired woman with a massive shotgun strapped to her back. She's wearing a black leather jacket and a red bandana, and her braided hair is pulled back to reveal a large metallic ear cuff on a kind of Elizin, but not all the way Elizin-shaped ear, marking her as half-Hume, half-Elizin. The filthy man recognizes her as Hilda. She warns that if they lay a finger on us, they'll lose the hand. Shocked, they back off.
I tried really hard to be unimpressed because I remembered, as I know that the game will forget about this, but still cool.
Yeah.
Very good character.
This character intro is great. It's like, okay, yeah, we've got a bro. We've got a bro who's going to kick asses.
Yeah, all the stuff she got up to in Endwalker was so cool.
Shit. Hilda then turns to us and asks what she's done to deserve to be called on such glorious heroes. The screen fades out and we all retire to the more private confines of the Forgotten Knight. Inside the bar, a duty starts. Hilda smiles at the inn's proprietor and hands him a big sack of gold. The proprietor, in turn, clears out the room for us so that we can have a private conversation, and we tell her the whole sordid tale of the secrets that we uncovered on our pilgrimage to first go negotiate with and then kill Nidhogg. the Holy See's centuries-long cover-up, and Aemmerich's foolhardy plan to confront the Archbishop. Hilda quickly understands that this information would shatter the High House's legitimacy. Even the thugs who we found menacing Totaru realize what consequences might befall Sir Aemmerich for trying to expose the truth. Hilda thinks this might be what Aemmerich wants to begin with, a noble sacrifice to prove his claims. He wants to be a martyr. She admires our willingness to stick our necks out to help others, but wants to know what our rescue plan has to do with her. Alphanode implores her that we will need all the help we can get if we mean to storm the vault.
This bums me out a little bit, because like even the poor people have never considered that like their entire political system of nobility ruling over the common people is invalid because it's stupid and completely pointless, and not because we're all nobles.
Right. Yeah, no, it's like all these people who keep fomenting unrest because they're sick of the status quo, because they get shit on all the time. But they're not like, hey, we should just overthrow this until someone's like, oh, by the way, the nobility doesn't actually have holy blood more than y'all do. Everybody's got holy blood.
Yeah. And then this is my favorite cutscene, because this reveals that everyone in the game, they could trick us all into role playing secretly. Because a cutscene starts and a guy just comes flying off the balcony directly onto the table next to you, like every time. And it happens because he's thrown from the balcony to the inn's floor by Charibert, the chief inquisitor of the Holy See and Knight of the Heaven's Award, as he just rolls in, smirking that he smells the unmistakable scent of heresy. And then I say out loud, smelling your upper lip, King. And my child just goes, ugh, from the other room, because that's my favorite joke. He gazes down and observes that the honored guests of House Fortops are consorting with the Queen of Rats. He scolds us for plotting insurrection and tells us that the sickness we mean to spread must be burned out before the infection takes hold. Hilda draws her gun on him and fires, but a magical shield blocks her shots, which is so cool. It looks like Protect from Final Fantasy X, but the way they layer it is really sick. I am very disappointed this has never come up again.
I know. Fucking great.
Like, why are we in your Final Fantasy game when there's no magic in cutscenes like this? People should just get shot at more. It's cool.
For real.
Great sound clip for later. Just me saying people should get shot at more. It's cool.
And me going, for real.
Charbert laughs and says that simple creatures like rats will always attack when cornered. He asks her to meet him outside, and we take off up the stairs after her. And then we find out that Charbert is named Charbert because he's a fire mage.
Yeah.
Because he calls fireballs down on us with his staff, which leave burning circles where they land that remain throughout the fight. It took a really long time because I was one level under leveled and had the enemy list turned off. So by the time I noticed there were ads, there were like 12 of them.
Oh, God.
And because the enemy is off, it took me a while to figure out that 4 of them were healers. He does start the fight with just a couple of underlings, which you would notice if you paid more attention than I did. And the goal is to keep them bunched up so we can AoE them down. Unless you're a samurai, then you cry a single tear as you 1-2-3 your way through the whole fight. A second large wave of reinforcements rushes in to defend him, and we just keep doing it until the fight is over. And then I have to go do a level roulette because I'm level 56 and 9/10.
Oh, God. Yeah, brutal. Finally, the experience curve is slowing down to a more normal pace, but it also means that we're like, oh, fuck. I have to level a little bit again. God damn it.
It's also because I'm spreading it over 3 different classes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, same. But it is slower than it was in A Realm Reborn, where they want you to just like get to 50 as soon as fucking possible. Like 90% of the way through the fight, Sir Horchafont joins the fray, demanding to know why we're all fighting and imploring us to stop this madness, but attacking Charibert alongside us nonetheless. Because he is just like the world's best ally. He's like, oh, you fucking somebody up? I don't get it, but I'll fuck him up with you. We wound Charibert, who commends our talents. Lucia, Aemmerich's head guard, runs in from the stairs to the upper city and draws her sword, shouting, enough! She sprints towards the Inquisitor, leaps into the air, and strikes down at him. Charibert smirks again and somersaults backwards onto the top of a turret. Hilda fires on him, but he leaps away again. When Hilda calls Charibert a lucky bastard, Alphanod chides that we were the lucky ones, actually. If the fight kept going, an innocent bystander would have been hurt or killed. Lucia explains that the Heaven's Ward visited the Temple Knight's headquarters, and she figured they would also visit the Forgotten Knight. In response to Sir Aymeric's imprisonment on suspicion of heresy, the Heaven's Ward had been granted full authority over the Temple Knights. About half the knights are still loyal to Sir Aymeric and currently answer to Lucia. The other half, who always opposed Aymeric's promotion and thought it was him being a Nepo baby, have gathered at the vault as ordered. Hilda deduces that the ward is actually expecting our assault.
Hilda says that her people are sick of having to live off scraps of their so-called betters, and if Alphanod and Lucia mean to change things to discard, she and her people mean to join us. We all nod in agreement under a broken statue of a Knight of the Twelve. Lucia mentions that she never likes Sir Charibert because he took too much pleasure in torturing suspected heretics. Totaru wonders if all of the Knights of the Heaven's Ward are as bad as the ones we have met. And Hilda addresses us, sure that we are wondering why she chose the name The Mongrel. It's because that's what she is, and she's not ashamed of it anymore. And her pure blood pups have more in common with her than she does. Some of their mothers were even cast off just for a bit of fun, like hers. Her revolution isn't targeting all the highborn, though. House Hyenart, for example, has done right by the lowborn. And didn't we already do the Machinist questline?
We did 30 to 50, but a lot of stuff here is from the 50 to 60. Like we break a lowborn guy out of a private prison arm a bunch of them. It's great.
Since I didn't read this thing and we just discussed it and said, this is a reference to the 50 to 60 Machinist questline. The time for talking is done now. Aymeric is rotting in his cell and we have to go rescue him. It really seems like my man was in like a white collar prison, because it seems like the worst thing that happened to him is he got some tennis elbow.
Yeah, for real. The next time we see him, he's limping, but he's not visibly wounded. And Charibert is busy trying to set us on fire, so he's not getting like flame tortured right now. He's weak, is what I'm trying to say.
Let me tell you about how successfully I got set on fire. I had like 3 times in the vault. All of them were spectacular.
Oh, man. Can't wait.
Let me tell you, it's before they moved the checkpoints to before the boss instead of after.
I do hate that they had to insert the like, well, hashtag not all nobles here. Her being like, well, I mean, House Hyenart helped us. It is true. House Hyenart are bros to the lowborn compared to the other houses, but it felt like trying to appease the middle class who are afraid of the riots. Very like, hey, don't worry, we're only going after the ones who suck.
Also, they're bros to the lowborn in the same way that liberals are friends to the impoverished. Like, in a way that, what if we made sure you didn't get extrajudicially executed but did not improve your life?
Right. Yeah. What?
Uh-oh. Also, that's untrue because the liberals don't do that anymore either.
No, not that. No, exactly. That's not true anymore. Also, they also do the thing that liberals used to do, which is, what if we stop you from getting extrajudicially executed and also give you the promise of an entry level job somewhere? Great. Great praxis.
We replaced the entry-level job with spending all day inside of the DSHS.
Woof. So, the next quest is called A Knight's Calling, and while Hilda admits to working in secret to undermine the High Houses, her people were not, in fact, the ones who threw the gates open for the heretics. That, apparently, was also the Temple Knight's doing. Or maybe the Heaven's Ward themselves, in order to provide justification to slaughter all the heretic sympathizers in the broom in one fell swoop. Horchafont follows her reasoning. The ward did not account for Lady Isehart's intervention and have been forced to improvise. Now that everyone's up to speed on extremely recent events, Lucia and Hilda begin discussing plans. We love to see two girl bosses winning. Step one is to divert the attention of the High Houses away from the city, which Hilda's contacts in the upper crust, who are mostly lowborn knight recruits, could help with. Most of these people swore their oath only out of desire for a better life and might help our cause if they could do that without the yoke of fealty around them.
So Lucia's plan is to manufacture lies of another heretic attack that would render these knights unable to join in the defense of the vault. Hilda thinks that she can pull this off, but it won't keep the knights away from the city for very long, so coordinating timing will be important. To elaborate on the strategy, she's basically calling the cops and telling them that someone is shoplifting at Walgreens, so they all go there to kill that guy. Yeah. Step two is for the assault team. One squad will pursue Amaric's rescue, and the other squad will move to apprehend the Archbishop. Estinian and Lucia will be on Team Jailbreak, and we will be on Team Hope Nap. I wish they'd changed this cutscene a little bit, because, like, you get Temple Banneret, which is just like C tier Estinian anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Adding NPC trusts to these earlier duties when they don't have all the named characters, like,
and like the plot wasn't designed for it, so characters are in weird places. But like here, you have like all plot important NPCs except for Estinian isn't here,
right? Because he is on Team Jailbreak.
Did you know Horshifa also has a gap closer?
No. Wow. Fuck. Why do they all get gap closers before we do?
They're all paladins and they all have a gap closer. It's almost like it would be really important to completing content where the boss tries to zone you.
Yeah, for real. Square, why do you like just dangle these impossible carrots in front of our faces? We will have to fight through the vault to the very top to get to the Archbishop's private chambers, and when the Heaven's Ward realizes what we're up to, they are certain to fly to their master's side and try to stop us. This has a side benefit of drawing more forces away from the jail for Estinian and Lucia to do their thing. Temple Knights loyal to our cause have already secured the entrance to the vault. Once we are inside, they will signal to Team Jailbreak. If everything goes according to plan, Amaric and the rest of the gang will meet up with us to confront the Archbishop together. At the very top of Ishgard, in front of the towering structure that houses the Archbishop and the seat of the Holy See's power, a loyal Temple Knight squire informs us that everyone else is in position, and it's time for us to enter the vault.
The massive main chamber of the vault looms before us. Messing iron gates bar our progress, and stained glass windows flood the area with golden light. As we make our way through the pews and side hallways, Temple Knights block our path to delay us, and vault clergy lob spells at us. I died to one of these trying to, because I realized my AoEs weren't actually in my hotbar and I did have them the whole time.
Fuck.
I just ate one of like the cannon blasts while in a menu, which made me extra mad, not because I died, but because it closed the menu.
No.
Well, we make our way up a staircase at the back of the congregation and are met by a knight of the Heaven's Ward, Sir Adelfelt Brightblade, which is a sick name, and his host. I made it sound like he had a host of a podcast. Weird emphasis there.
His esteemed co-host.
That's right. His men go. It's really weird that these guys are here because they die in 20 seconds and add nothing to the fight at all.
Yeah, it's just flavor, but it's like shitty flavor.
Well, actually, it's good flavor because it does make, combined with how fast he dies, it makes what happens come out like a big surprise, actually, because this is the first time this happens in the expansion now that I think about it.
Yeah, it's true. That's true.
So we kill his little normal guys, and then he has like, he seems to be really easy to kill. But then at like half health, he goes immune, floats above us, and does like a little rain wind, knocking us all backwards. And Alphanode is shocked as Adelpha quadruples in size, now bigger than before, and has a long flowing red crest on his helmet. In his new form, he hits much harder and has a host of new attacks.
This guy I think is one of the guys who we like really didn't know anything about, and it makes me very sad that a lot of the Knights 12 are not that characterized. I would like to know more about Sir Adelpho Brightblade. It's a sick name.
Sorry, no time for that, because we spent 15 quests navigating around these ledges in the Jervanian Forelands.
For most of the fight, Sir Adelpho casts party-wide damage and focuses on our tank, occasionally pausing to stun one of us at random and deliver a heavy hit. Halfway through the encounter, he leaps into the air and dashes around the room, depositing orbs of light around the arena. These orbs explode in the order they're summoned in, and so we move around the arena to a safe space, or at least to try to outrun the blasts. While the orbs are exploding, he targets one of us for execution. We scatter away from the targeted party member. Once the last orb has burst, he leaps up and lands on his target in a small AoE. This is completely trivial if you're running it as a duty with other players, but because if you die, the whole party dies in the trust version. If you're not paying attention to the orbs, you can get like hit by a couple of them and then get targeted by his execution and actually die. I was very demoralized when I died to this boss that I've never once died to in a duty.
That's okay. I died to the next one. Don't feel bad.
All right.
But the next one has the long run up through upstairs.
It does.
They added a new marker to this. There used to not be a marker for who he's going to like do the nail dive bomb to, but there is here.
That's helpful.
It's like a unique marker, like that like circle of like white and black diamonds around them. I have never seen that marker before.
Yeah, nor have I. Strange. So he repeats the orb and execution combo one more time before we bring him down. He shrinks down into his Elizan form again and teleports away at the last moment, shocked that we were able to defeat him.
It seems like it'd be easier to teleport away in your like super wizard form, but whatever.
Yeah.
We make our way upstairs to the Chantry Cloister. More spellcasting clergy block our way, this time in frustratingly small groups that are really, really, really far apart. This is where you wish that things were not actually to scale, like they were in A Realm Reborn. I would love for everything to be too small again. They take a lot of effort to budge up, and in the elevator room that will take us further up, two armored statues come to life and attack us. Borchefant is horrified to realize that the Holy See would turn the vault itself against us. It's called the Vault. A vault is inherently oppositional, Horchefant.
Yeah, but I'm a noble boy. I'm a noble boy who deserves to just walk through, and it is a betrayal of the Holy See to set these magical statues on us.
We ascend to the inner sanctum. Ornate marble tiles the floor, and there are waterfall fountains built into the wall. A red ivy snakes around the column windows, and the light here takes on the deep orange of sunset. And a pair of huge mechanical knight chess pieces with metal arms and legs and pincer wings guard the gate to Sir Grinot. Grinot is waiting for us in the chapter house. He vows to cut us to pieces despite using a hammer. Horchefant reminds us that we have bested him once before and can do it again. And this is when everyone realizes, oh, this is the guy from the beginning of the expansion. It felt like a year ago.
Yeah, for real.
Like his knight brother, he starts out normal sized and after a bit of punishment turns super sized.
Grinot's main attack is an arena-wide AoE that follows a floral pattern along the ground. It like it looks like a paper doily almost.
Yeah, but cool. Made out of like evil magic.
Yeah. An evil doily. We stay out of the red and black zones and huddle in the thin safe spaces while continuing to wail on him. He also calls damage puddles down on one of us at a time. If any of us step in the puddles before they disappear, they implode, dealing heavy damage and inflicting us with the heavy status effect, making us slow. Throughout the fight, Sir Grinot fires a radial line attack from the center of the arena and will open a dimensional rift at the edge of it. These rifts stay open for the entire fight, and drifting too close to them will deal continuous damage and inflict us with a Vuln stack. Occasionally, he tries to trap us in his rifts and puddles by knocking us all backwards towards the edges of the arena with an axe slam. We make sure that there isn't a roiling black disc behind us when we see him start to crouch down.
Or you notice that Horshapot runs into this, even though there was no need to, and you go, I wonder if this is a mechanic no one does because they're real people. And then you go in there and get stunned and then immediately one-shotted by Grinot and have to run through the entire upstairs again.
Oh my god, Horshapot has plot armor, which is extremely ironic for like 20 minutes from now.
Well, this plot armor sure is heavy. Time to take it off.
As we defeat Grinot, he shrinks down to normal size. He retorts, though, that time is on his side, and he teleports away. Horshapot commends us for our fighting thus far, but reminds us that the battle is far from over.
We head into the inner sanctum. The magically animated knight statues and chess pieces roam the halls. Marble chambers give way to towering spires and open sky as we enter the Hall of the Spear. There's a Hellonic priest in there who has a lot of hit points for some reason, and when you kill him, he is actually invulnerable and goes to 0.1%, which I found out because I'm a samurai. And he'll animate the four stone gargoyles as his final defense. On the final upper platform, just before the door to the Archbishop's private chambers, we see Thorin escaping towards his waiting airship as one final Heavensward knight waits for us, Sir Charibert the Inquisitor. Charibert starts big and transformed, and his voice is near demonic as he tells us that sickness must be purged. He calls down large AoE Heaven's Flame circles on all four of us at once, forcing us to run out of the circles before the attack lands. Or you try to greed out your samurai art and then get hit by all four of these and die instantly.
Oh, rip. F.
Okay, last week I had one of these that went an hour and 15 minutes, and 45 minutes was on this fight because the tank was basically min eye level and the healer had never healed before, and it was miserable. Because this is also like the first fight with like tethers, like the chains and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There are like a lot of mechanics to this fight out of nowhere.
There are, and it is taxing on healers because it like he keeps like firing arena wides throughout the fight that you have to heal up for because he's got like a bunch of other attacks that immediately trigger after the AoEs.
This one was so spicy. I had to teach the scholar how to manually control their pet to tell you how this fight went.
Wow. like Chris mentioned, he regularly will chain two of us together, which deals continuous damage on both of us until we can break the tether by running to the opposite ends of the arena. He also unleashes a powerful arena-wide attack called Altar Pyre that our healer has to quickly regenerate us from.
This was scarier before some recent updates because now every single healer's bubble covers this entire arena.
Oh, thank God. Thank God. Because a lot of especially Astrologian's heal and mitigation bubble is typically pretty tiny, or at least it used to be.
It's so big now.
It's almost as big as Stellar Detonation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It used to be a feature that the Scholar's one was enormous. Mm-hmm. And now the Scholar's one is still bigger than the other ones, but comically so.
One of his like really unique mechanics here is Charibert will summon chess knights at one end of the arena in a particular pattern. After a pause, they all march in a straight line towards the opposite end. We find the gaps in their formations to avoid being trampled.
Yeah, this is like not a big deal, and I'm not going to pretend it's hard later, but it's a lot compared to everything before, when later on he does this while doing other stuff like chains and the circles all at once.
Right. And it's especially surprising, I think, given a lot of the ways that they have nerfed the post A Realm Reborn patch cycle duties and some of the first half of Heavensward duties to be like easier and more manageable. So the fact that this like just stacks mechanics on top of one another is a bit surprising for sure.
This might be actually the first time in the game where there's a lot of mechanics all happening all at the same time that need resolved in different ways. It's not the first time that there's complex mechanics like when you're dealing with Ravana or Ramu and stuff, but since the changes, like notably since the changes to like Midgar Sormer, this might be the first time where there's a lot of different mechanics that are all overlapping at once.
Yeah.
So like there's like a big mechanical spike.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also definitely died a couple of times to this boss doing the trust version of the fight.
Alphanote is not a good healer.
No, he's not. Yeah, he's not. So after we have taken about half of his health, Charibert moves to the center of the arena, becomes untargetable, and summons two more chess knights and also a bunch of fucking holy flames around the platform. We quickly destroy these holy flame adds before he can hit us with his ultimate attack, Pure of Heart, which will multiply based on how many flames are left up. After Pure of Heart, he repeats his attacks until he goes down.
Charibert is shocked that we were able to defeat him. He kneels, panting, unable to teleport away like his brothers did. He has no idea how we were able to defeat their power. Zephyrin appears from the doors in front of us and commands him to fall back. We give chase, but we're too late, and the airship flies away over our heads as with the Archbishop on it. Very good. Mm-hmm. It's very silly to see the Archbishop standing in a Final Fantasy airship. Yeah. He looks very weird, not in a chair. My man just probably trips over his beard walking around. It like touches the ground and drags on it.
Fashion tips from Ramu.
That's right. Pistidian, Lucia, and a wounded Aberic rush in behind us. Aberic calls out to his father, pleading to know why he is doing this, saying, Nidhogg has fallen and there's no need for further deception. Now is the time to renounce the lies which led us down this path to start anew. Thordon does not look back at his son, but raises his eyes and calls Aberic a fool. Renouncing these lies would tear down the very pillars of their society, their history, and their values. Everything they have built over 1,000 years.
God, fucking evil guy being like, I have to maintain this lie to preserve our way of life. But like, your way of life sucks for most of your people. You're preserving this tradition for like a handful of your cronies, my guy.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he is the evil guy, so whatever. I also now I'm cursed with the image of Ramu being like a beard grooming YouTube influencer in Eorzea.
Hey guys, Grey Arbiter here.
Thordon's words are all the signal that we need. Horshafant nods at us and we rush the airship. A transformed Heavensward knight summons a massive glowing lance and hurls it at us. Horshafant sees it before we do and screams at us to look out. He valiantly blocks the magical lance with his shield, but the power of the Heavensward is simply too great. It pierces his shield and goes straight through his body, causing him to cough up blood and collapse onto the walkway. Archbishop Thordon turns to his airship pilot and tells him that Aziz La awaits. We rush towards Horshafant, whose wound is still glowing and smoldering with energy. Aemerich stumbles towards his fallen brother as the airship flies off. The wound is too deep. Alphanode cannot mend it. Horshafant stirs, blood trailing from his mouth. He asks our forgiveness and is relieved that we are unharmed. He could not bear the thought of our demise. He reaches out his hand and we grab it, an anguished look on our faces. He asks us not to look at him like that. A smile better suits a hero, he sighs, and then drifts off. Horshafant is gone.
That hits real different in 2023 when your character's a lady, though.
Oh my god, yeah. Fucking dying thought. Smile more, baby.
It is a bummer that you get the shield as only as a housing decoration and not as like a zero defense item that you can glam. I would love
to do that.
Oh my God,
to glam the shield as a paladin, it would rock.
Oh, that would be so good. Yeah, you're right.
Turns out only the wealthy can enjoy the have the leisure time to enjoy memorabilia. The squire at the vault entrance is at a loss for words. He informs us that the others are gathered at Four Thomas Manor. We head inside our guardian home away from home. We make a move towards Count Edmont with a sympathetic look, but the grieving father stops us. Count Edmont refuses to look at us, and he is in the bargaining phase. He assures himself that a knight lives to serve, to protect, and to sacrifice. There is no greater calling. He commands us to leave him to mourn and to give chase to the Archbishop for his son and the nation he loved. Everyone bows their head, and Alfano can't read the fucking room and says that his sacrifice will not be forgotten. And that's when Count Edmont drops his cane, collapses to the ground, his shoulders shaking with tears. My son is all he can choke out. Outside, Alphanode confides that he couldn't stay silent in that moment. Thanks, Alphanode.
God, yeah.
When all others had forsaken us, Lord Horchafant took us in. He was our beacon of hope in a world of darkness and let us know that earrings could be cool. He did everything he could to raise our spirits and get us to fight our battles with courage and conviction.
The last quest that we are going to cover this episode is called The Sins of Antiquity.
Just to tell you, I hate this quest. This is what made me really, truly hate Echo flashbacks. Because, like, they're in one of the coolest looking rooms in the expansion, and I just have to listen to this shitty 10-second music loop over and over again and look at it in sepia instead of it looking cool.
Yeah. And also, this is it, like... This is one of the first times that we get an echo flash of something that like just happened a couple of days ago instead of like a long ass time ago. And so, yeah, there's a part of me that's like, why couldn't we have just seen this? Why couldn't we have just seen this?
Yeah, the way they would do it is that Amarek would be imprisoned in the vault. Estinian would be with you. And this would be a long mid dungeon cutscene.
Oh, yeah. True.
And that's why they didn't do it, because. Otherwise, you would get into a situation where you got into with Praetorium and stuff like that.
Sure, sure. Yeah, okay, yeah.
Because I think that's how you would have to do it, right?
Mm-hmm. Alphanode, still grieving, believes that we should press on with our mission. He asks Tataru to return to her duties at the Forgotten Knight. Meanwhile, we follow him to the Temple Knight's headquarters to check in on Sir Amarek. Amarek is not doing well. Though he thanks us for our aid and his physical wounds are healing, he is learning that some wounds do not heal. He looks up from his desk and right at us. We get an echo flash of Amarek's heated recent conversations with his father.
Archbishop Thordon admits he knows the truth of Thordon and the Knights 12's betrayal and butchery of Ratatoskr, and that Ishgard's high houses can claim no more of a bloodline than the commoners. He believes that the Twelve's one mistake was to show mercy, since Nidhogg was soon gifted with one of Hraesvelgr's eyes and was able to launch a thousand-year campaign of vengeance. The first Azure Dragoon was born when Thordon's son Haldrath learned how to use one of Nidhogg's eyes in defense of Ishgard's people. Thordon asks his son, will he answer for his father's sins? Will Amarek's son in turn answer for his father's? If a man cannot atone for his sins in the course of his own life, should his progeny be held to account? While Thordon's sin was unforgivable, should his descendants meekly surrender themselves to an eternity of punishment?
It is very funny in Final Fantasy XIV's version of elf Catholicism that the Pope says all of my evil deeds were trying to prevent original sin. Like, I'm trying to make it so that the children are not responsible for the sins of the father, and I've made the world much worse by doing so. It's goofy,
but the context of it is weird, because if you apply it to actual Catholicism, he's literally trying to kill God so that way we can't be punished for original sins.
Yeah. He's trying to be the JRPG protagonist and also the god that the JRPG protagonists try to kill at the same time. Thordon refuses to see Ishgard's children sacrificed in a vain attempt to appease an implacable foe. Dragons are not like them. They live forever, and the passage of time does not dull their rage. No reparations will ever suffice. While this alone, he thinks, would be a fine justification for the war, Thordon knows that some men, like Aemerich, require a more compelling narrative to feel like they are committing themselves to a noble cause. Aemerich is disgusted. Thordon has given his people a lost cause, dooming Ishgardians to give their lives for a lie. Thordon counters that they do so gladly and proudly. He asks his son what he would say to them. What would he tell the grieving widows and mothers, that their loved ones died for nothing?
This comes off as less preposterous these days. People do love a lost cause.
Woof. Yeah, woof.
Aemerich stammers as his father continues, "Every archbishop has come to accept the necessity of the lie. He once hoped that Aemerich himself would become one of those men." Thordon gets up from his chair and tells Aemerich that soon he will free them all from the sins of antiquity and bring about the changes his son desires. He pounds his staff on the ground, and the two Heaven's Ward knights appear to flank Aemerich. He commands them to question his son thoroughly to learn the names of his collaborators. Aemerich makes a move towards Thordon, but Zephyrin blocks him with his blade and Charybear smirks. We return to the present with a shake of our head and look at Aemerich. We spill the beans to our allies about what we saw, and Aemerich is embarrassed that the Echo showed us something so shameful.
God, we just fucking, like, we don't even ask him if it's okay if we divulge this. We're just like, okay, so here's what I just saw Aemerich do. It's extremely embarrassing for him.
Uh-huh. Been hanging out with Alphanode too much.
Mm-hmm.
He is embarrassed that his words left him when his father's convictions were so firm. Alphanode remembers that Horshafant taught him the importance of differentiating between words, deeds, and beliefs. Our dearly departed bro would likely judge Thordon's conviction to be nothing more than self-serving delusion.
Still, Alphanode wonders and fears what kind of change Thordon means to bring about. Aemerich believes it has something to do with the strange and unusual powers the Heaven's Ward displayed in the vault. Lucia had never seen anything like the spear which Sir Zephyrin killed Horshafant with. These powers reminded Aemerich of the way that Old King Thordon and his Knights 12 are depicted in the Holy Scriptures. Alphanode makes the connection to primals instantly. The Knights were presenting as fabrications which have become objects of faith instilled with the belief of countless devoted souls.
If Lady Iceheart was able to use her own body as a vessel for summoning, Aemerich sees no reason why others could not. We must find the Heaven's Ward and stop them before it is too late. He emphatically entreats the Scions once again to assist him in bringing his father to justice. We sign on emphatically as revenge for our bro. Alphanode agrees, since the Scions' main duty is to fight the primals anyway. Aemerich cannot join us because he has to tend to the chaos that his father's absence will foment in Ishgard. He needs to unite Ishgard, for he believes that they will all have need of each other. Estinian pledges his lance to the defense of Ishgard, and Lucia means to join us in our pursuit of Thordon. Thordon mentioned Azus Lá before departing the vault, and our next task is to figure out what that is, so this is the first time we have ever heard of it.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we'll be covering next time, is figuring out what the fuck Azus Lá is. What did you think of this episode?
I think that this episode, now that we're finally three quarters of the way through the expansion, we finally arrived at the part where people go, wow, FF14 got good all of a sudden.
Uh-huh.
Very goofy.
Yeah, God. But so, like, this is kind of just the Moonbreda, like, thing again, where they introduced someone who actually has some kind of personality and then use that person as a noble sacrifice for our cause. This one works way better than Moonbreda because Horshafant is around for way fucking longer than Moonbreda was.
Yeah, yeah. You didn't just meet him 10 minutes ago.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, while it's true that he kind of, like, takes a back seat once the real plot starts going, he still shows up and reminds us, like, oh, right, this dude really likes us and believes in us and is, like, a sweet guy who has a sense of, like, justice and goodness within him. And so it is genuinely sad. And also the cutscenes are directed a lot better. For the most part, anyway, like there's like a real sense of purpose to the action and the way that things are choreographed and shot, finally.
And the game gives you a chance to remember that this happened. Like, you could walk into your apartment and be reminded about Horshafant rather than the game completely forgetting that Moonbreda ever existed.
Right. Right. Yes, absolutely. It also, I think, like we've discovered in the episode itself, I know that this is also something that you said, is it like really does betray the liberal heart of Final Fantasy 14, because the revolution can only begin when there's like definitive proof that actually Ishgard was built on a lie. It doesn't matter that it was extremely oppressive for more than half its population, because, well, hey, I mean, we've got a religion that says it's legitimate, and they only start like really fighting back when there's incontrovertible proof that they're all noble, actually. Like that did make me sigh real heavily, but despite that, yeah, I'm motivated, I'm emotional. The fights themselves, like the vault itself, has some mechanically interesting fights for once. So, you know, that gets my motivation and adrenaline pumping too. So yeah.
It finally has unique AoE markers that also respect your colorblind settings.
Oh, thank God.
Hey, don't forget, we met a cool new character who we'll enjoy hanging out with for a long time.
Is that a joke about Hilda? Sorry, I laughed, but then
sure
I was like, that, okay, good. I was
sure
like,
was.
Great. Yeah. What the fuck? They did her dirty. That's I guess that's spoilers, but just like, yeah, where's Hilda? Where Hilda string?
Excuse me. Hilda shows up for 3 seconds in the quest where you get to enter the Ishgardian housing area. That's the same thing as an ongoing important character.
Oh god. God damn it. God damn it.
That's all until next time, when we'll be doing whatever.
Yeah.
Peace out, fuckers.
And also with you.
Thanks for being a patron. Your continued patronage helps us to make the shows that we all love without it becoming a financial burden or having to put ads in them. In case you didn't know, we have other shows that you might enjoy, such as Being Mr. Boot, Lightning Strikes Thrice, Being Jim Davis, and last but not least, Boku No Stop. You can help us out further by rating and reviewing your favorite show on iTunes and telling a friend about our podcast. Thanks for being a loyal patron. We'll see you next time.